The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Thank you very much. It's a distinct pleasure to be here again, and I feel gratified that I was reminded in the introduction about what the topic was last time, so I don't repeat the same topic. But truthfully, with a topic like this evening's, it's quite limiting. The version that I have over here is creating a family team, how the family as a cohesive unit of diverse individuals can inspire your children to succeed. Well, there's a lot of very key words in this topic, that's for sure. Family, team, cohesive, diverse, individuals, inspire, and succeed. Really covers the gamut of some of the serious issues that we deal with as parents. The truth of the matter is that we're just beginning to realize how serious these issues are. I travel a bit and am in touch with a lot of different individuals and communities, and we're going through very, very difficult times. People used to say, don't talk about it, it's depressing. People used to say, don't talk about it, people are in denial. People used to say, nobody wants to do anything about it, nobody's going to do anything about it. Maybe more accurately, nobody knows what to do about it. But today, I don't think anyone is suggesting that we can't talk about or we shouldn't talk about these things, because they're reality, they're sad reality that every community faces. Rahmanul Islam. I guess that the most that we could do with any inspiration and any motivation and any adrenaline that is pumping based on the difficulties that we become acutely aware of is to see what we could do about reversing this tragic trend, changing the tide of the serious issues that so many of our kids fall prey to, and hoping that in the process, with a united community, efforts of machanchim, rabbonim, and parents, that we could at least make a difference for the future, if we can't resolve all of the problems of the past. Now, the question is always asked about what's the most important ingredient in the raising, in the proper raising, in the proper development of our children. And some ask it, who's to blame for the problems? Is it the schools and the machanchim? The parents would like to choose that option. Is it the parents? The machanchim tend to agree with that option. Is it the kids? Everybody seems to agree with that option. Is it the world out there and all of the decadence in society? Many people mistakenly think that that's the right answer. The truth of the matter is, it's probably a very sophisticated and complicated blend of parents, schools, machanchim, communities, community leaders, of course, the individual children, students. And I would say that the world out there is probably not the cause of the problem. It's probably just making it a lot worse. And when there is a problem, when there is some deviation, when there are some difficulties, when there is a void that our children feel, the access to the sickness and the decadence and the depravity of the outside world compounds it and certainly makes them go distances and to places and to issues that they never might have been able to even dream of, let alone to accomplish. But to blame it on that, I think, would be a mistake. The family certainly is a very critical ingredient in the development of any children. I hope that in your community the situation is a little bit different, maybe a lot different. I hope it's a lot different. But in the world today, unfortunately, the observant community is a microcosm of the community at large, and the community at large, by and large, as a whole, the family unit is not doing that well. Families are not sticking together as much as they did in the past. Even those that are sticking together are doing so sometimes on very, very thin ice. Children are extremely perceptive and they're aware of many issues that we would love them to be totally oblivious to. And therefore, the family as the bulwark of strength of our children, as maybe it used to be in generations gone by, and it's probably not too many generations, where it formed an anchor, where it was the bedrock of the security and of the guidance and of the inspiration and of the future success of our children, is something that we certainly can't take for granted today. I think that some of these ingredients that were mentioned in this elaborate title that I'm not quite sure who came up with it, maybe I even did, I'm not sure, it was a long time ago. I think some of these concepts could be helpful to ponder a bit. A family team, a team. I think everybody knows that if as father and mother, if as husband and wife, we are not completely united in our goals and aspirations for our children, we send mixed and at odds messages. We fester, we allow to fester in our homes confusion on the parts of our children. And worst of all, we allow that little Yetzer Hora that exists inside every one of our children, and Baruch Hashem it does, it's a very healthy force for development, for challenge, for Bechira Chofshis, and for the development of an individual as a mensch. It allows the Yetzer Hora to wiggle in and to find rationalization and excuses and basis to do things that are inappropriate. Because in that parental concept, I could find something that there's some discord, there's some disagreement, there's a machlokes about it. Okay, I could go whichever way I want. You know, I'll pick and choose. Not only that, they don't only pick and choose, they manipulate. They know how to work their way in between, and they could turn everybody against each other and then just scoot out the door and do whatever they please. So working as a team is critical. That's a husband and wife. Having a clear sense of what our mission is, of what our purpose is, of what our standards are, of what we're looking for is critical. That doesn't mean that there's no room or that it isn't essential for our children to develop as individuals. The individuality in our families and in our homes has to be in the lives, in the personas, in the development of our children rather than ourselves. We have to be united because otherwise we seed confusion. As a team, we have to be able to articulate in unison our goals. But that's not always so simple. Repeating the same mantra by father and mother doesn't usually help. You know, the Mishnah says that when they check the Edus to see if they're Edei Sheker, they take them into a room, speak to each one separately, and then the Mishnah says, Im nimtzeu divrehem michuvonim, if we discover that their words are going in the same kivun, the same direction, then we know that they're telling the truth. And the Goyin actually is old Maisa with the Vilna Goyin, how he discovered two Edus that weren't Edus, that they were lying, because he found that their stories were too identical. It wasn't Nimtzu Mechuvonim. They had rehearsed it. If our kids feel that we have rehearsed the lines, you're just saying what my mother said, told you to say, you're just saying what your husband told you to say, it's not going to work. It has to be in different tones, in different words. Maybe it's a little more cerebral from one parent. Maybe it's a little more emotional from another parent. But they get this sense that we both independently and collectively believe that this is what's right. Not only do we believe that this is what's right, we're passionate about it. Maybe the father shows his passion in different ways, or maybe he doesn't show it as much. Maybe his passion only comes out in the way he runs to learn at night, or the way he gets up to make sure he's on time for the minyan. And maybe the mother shows her passion in motherly ways, in womanly ways, in emotional ways. But they feel a home with a sense of direction and a sense of passion for Torah, a sense of passion for Yiddishkeit, a sense of passion for the goals and the values and the aspirations that we have for our children. Passion is contagious. And the team has to be passionate. But passion can also be dangerous. Passion is overwhelming. Passion doesn't allow the observer to feel any freedom of movement. I'm too overwhelmed by this passion. I don't know what to do. It's like it's a matter of life and death. And that can be inspiring, but it can be dangerous. And it can be dangerous for many reasons. And I think that this is very important for us to know. If I had to, and this I may have mentioned the last time I was here, if I had to identify one word which is more responsible for more of the problems that we find with the best of our children today, I would guess. Should I ask the audience? No, okay. I would guess that the word is pressure. We have no idea how much religious pressure our children are under. Because, you know, they're very serious. They're very innocent. They're very honest. They're sensitive and they're intelligent. And they've learned early on that there's right and wrong. They've learned early on that there's a creator and a purpose for creation. And when they hear that there are responsibilities, they take those responsibilities very seriously. I dare say, not knowing the people in the community here directly, maybe more seriously than we take them. You know, as adults, as seasoned members of the society in which we live, we get a chanetze, you know, like, yeah, this is what's right, but it's not so terrible, I'm only human, and yeah, make a mistake over here, and we have all kinds of... A kid, straight as an arrow, even if he doesn't show it. But inside, that's the way he feels. And it creates a pressure. I must. They become religious perfectionists, and they become living pressure cookers that can explode at any moment. So this is something that, although the passion is very important to inspire, it has to be tempered, that it doesn't overwhelm. There's another danger of this team inspiring too much passion, although the passion is critical for that inspiration. And that is, they won't feel free to talk to us if we can't handle any deviation. My mother is so passionate about her Yiddishkeit. My father is so intense and he cares so much and is gatemon in Leben and this is his whole life and he's Mesa Nefesh. How can I tell him the terrible question that I thought of yesterday? How can I tell him the thought that I had yesterday? How could I tell him what I did yesterday? Or what I saw yesterday? Or even what my friend tried to get me to do when I withheld the temptation, but tomorrow I'm not sure I'll be able to. Can't confide because my mother, she'll chalash, she'll have a nervous breakdown. My father, he'll have a heart attack. They won't be able to take it. So we have to find a very, very delicate balance between a passion that's uplifting and inspiring, and I guess the word is coolness, and a certain coolness, casualness that just says, like, you know, this is the way we feel. This is how passionate we are. But on the other hand, Anybody can feel free to say anything to us because we can handle it. And we can work with you. And we can tolerate it. And we know what it is. We understand the challenges. We know, and this is, kids, don't hear this enough from us. We know that it's harder to grow up today than it was when we were going to school. We know that the challenges and the difficulties and the pressures and the lack of inspiration and so much in the world, despite all of the successes of our establishment communities, make it so difficult for our kids to grow today. And we understand this, and we let them know, and we they can talk to us. They have to be able to be inspired by the family, and they have to feel free to talk to the family about anything. And that's a very... it's a delicate balance. It's like we have to show them what we understand, where they're coming from. We know where they're coming from. We understand that the world is different today. We know the challenges. Maybe we have to sometimes talk about it casually with them so they see that we're in tune with what's going on, that we won't be shocked or overwhelmed. But on the other hand, we can't lose that excitement that we have. And excitement and passion coupled with this coolness and balance can truly lead our children in a derech that can be very, very uplifting for them. Okay, we're excited about our Yiddishkeit. We're passionate. We have this coolness as well that, you know, they still can talk to us about anything. We have 5 kids. We have 7 kids. We have 10 kids. We have 12 kids. And everyone is different. Everyone, every 2. I don't know how it goes in your family, but thing, if you really let yourself think about it, you'll see everyone, and maybe even more than everyone, because some days on Monday they're one way, and on Tuesday they're another way. And on Wednesday they went back, and on Thursday they found a new way. So I don't know how many combinations you have, or permutations of difference that you have, but my kids are different. What do? I got this passion for Yiddishkeit. Passion. It's the greatest thing in the world. This is the tachlis of the bria. I feel privileged. Ator b'chartonu mikolo amim. When I make a brocha shebochar bonu mikolo amim v'nosalonu esterosoi. Wow. I'm excited. I'm excited. And yet, you can talk to me, and I understand that not everybody is excited as I am. I'm willing to work with it. Everything is fine. But I got this kid that doesn't like to learn. And I got this kid that can't sit for more than 3 seconds or 3 minutes or 30 minutes. That's probably a lot. So what do I do? This one's interested. This one's interested in one thing. This one likes Chumash, but he doesn't like Gemara. This one likes Novi. This one likes this. This one likes sports, too into sports. This one is not enough into sports. Everybody's different. I got this passion. I also have another passion, especially in an insular community. And that's the passion of thinking and seeing what my neighbors have to say about me and my kids. It's also going to come to bear in this. So I got all these individuals. I got one kid who likes to dress. I don't know how to describe it, but horrifically. Okay? And I got another kid who just can't get out of bed in the morning. And then I got this rules. Oh, we have house rules. There used to be a term that they had. There's house rules over here. I haven't heard that term used in the last 30 years, by the way. I wonder why. There's house rules. You have to behave a certain way. There's certain things that are expected. No, that can't be because everyone's an individual. Everyone's an individual. Okay, you can get up at 7 o'clock. You can get up at 8 o'clock. The minyan starts at 8:30. You can get up at 9 o'clock. You can get up at 10 o'clock. You don't have to ever bother getting up again. And what's going to be? How do we live like that? Where's the rules? Where's the structure? And kids need structure. And they want structure. But everybody's different. I think, and I don't know the answer to this question, but that never stopped me from posing a question, because I think a question can get us to think, and you know, people that are smarter will come up with answers. But I think that an answer to this question has to be that our family must be taught, the parents must be united, the family unit must be convinced that everybody is different. And it's something that from the earliest stages of life, everybody is different. Just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu judges lefum tsar or agro, according to the difficulty is the schar, so too with human beings. Everyone's different. Certain people have it more difficult, certain people have it less difficult. Certain people have better at this than worse at this. Certain people have more challenges here, less challenges here, and so forth. And the concept has to be recognized. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to allow for all the differences, but we have to preach and propagate and convince and almost brainwash our families that, yes, people are different. And the reality is, as parents, by setting different expectations for different children, what we're really doing is having everybody live by the same rules. But the rules are a little different. The rule is everybody has to do their best. And everybody is expected to do their best. And that means that not everybody's going to be doing the same thing. Now, I'm sure at this point, everybody is lost. And you really wish you had stayed home tonight. Because you don't want to hear this. Or if you do want to hear this, you're confused because you say, how do you do that? And still expect my children to daven, and still expect my children to make brachos, and still expect my children to go to shul, still expect my children to learn, and to go to yeshiva, and to dress properly, and to wear tzitzis, and to this, and that, and so forth, and so on. Well, you gotta admit, I raise nice questions. But I think it can be done. It can be done because if we have this sense of individuality, then we sort of form a two-tier process in the home. And that two-tier process is something like this. There's a minimum standard that everybody has to keep. For example, in worst-case scenarios, and lo yaleinu, we shouldn't know from such things, where a kid is mamish off the derech. And the advice that many give, and I believe that it's the only advice in most, almost all of the cases, is keep this child home at all costs, if at all humanly possible. And the kid is going to be at home and not going to do all of the things that he or she is supposed to do. However, there has to be a bottom line. There has to be a minimal standard. Tzitzis, I mean, forgive me for getting too specific, tzitzis doesn't have to be part of that minimal standard for such a child who's off the derech because they're worn underneath. It's not so obvious. A yarmulke or something. Some of these kids come up with wild substitutes. But something on the head, that's just the way we walk around in our house. It's a sign of respect. It's a sign of respect when you go into someone's, if that's the dress, if it's considered offensive, you know, basic tznius is just the way you have to walk around this house. Chumrus, I mean, I don't know. I must share with you a little aside. Now, I may be starting up with the establishment here. I hope I'm not. They're nice people anyway, so they'll forgive me even if I do. A very choshev rov came to me not too long ago and said he has a problem. His daughter is a good girl. She's in high school. She doesn't even go to the local Beis Yaakovs in our community because her family wants something more, and she's agreeable. So she goes to, you know, that place, Borough Park. Did you ever hear of Borough Park? She goes to Beis Yaakov in Borough Park, okay? And she's happy there, relatively. She's not 100% on the same wavelength, but she's relatively happy. She comes home to her community, and she wants to wear long skirts. Now, I studied halacha for many years. Frankly, I haven't found the iser for long skirts. But it's something that today, for whatever reason, because of style and because of, you know, what's going on in the world, it's not acceptable. But this girl insists on wearing these long skirts. His wife insists on fighting with her about it. What should he do? And it's interesting, not what I told him, that's irrelevant. But it's interesting what the girl told him. She said, if her mother is going to make a fight about locally, not in school, not Cholila, but, you know, locally, she's in the community where she is, where she lives, it is acceptable. If her mother's going to make a fight about something like this, then she is going to assume you know, maybe like what we find by Odom and Chava, that, oh, if you add something to it, and then when you decrease the added piece and you see nothing happens, you know, you touch the Eitz Hadas, and then who knows what could happen next. She says, I'm afraid I'll start up with this, and it'll lead to other things. So we have to be able to draw, and again, this is not, if everything is fine, and if they'll listen to the Hashbon, they'll do what they're supposed to do, wonderful. But in certain situations, we have to be able to be bold enough to say, yes, for this particular child, I have to say that this is something I can't fight. And the other children have to understand, you know, she feels very strongly about this. And I really think, I don't think it's the right thing to do if you feel it's not the right thing to do. But it's not a violation of halacha, and she's not going to school like that. And therefore, I think I should not interfere. And that's because I respect her individuality, and I will respect your individuality accordingly. Now, of course, I know you're going to tell me, well, the next thing you'll see is the other kid will be doing the same thing. I'm not so sure. Because oftentimes, what our kids do is to test us. It's not so much the need to do this particular act or dress this particular way. It's more the testing of our love. And when with one child we pass the test, it might be, can't promise, that the next child will even say, you know, it's not so important. My parent has a reasonable attitude towards it. They're not forcing me. They would let me, but they don't think it's the right thing. You know, I can live with it. It doesn't mean that much to me as it meant to my sister. Now, I don't know if this is the solution to anything. I don't know if this is a good example or not, but I know we have to find such approaches. We have to be able to expect the minimum, being that in our home which cannot be tolerated, which is offensive to us. We can't control everybody's life. Now, the truth of the matter is that there's another piece of information which I think is relevant to this whole discussion. Are there still parents in the room who believe that they have control over their children? Let's say after age 8, 9, 7, 6, 12? Anybody? Really? Good luck to you. You know, either you're blessed or naive, one or the other. Maybe a little of both. Most of us don't really control our children. Most of us don't control our children. And what we have to learn to do is to recognize that and to work with them and to inspire them. And you know what else? To talk to them, to explain to them, to even, and this is what I know you're not going to like, negotiate with them. Sounds terrible, right? I'm going to negotiate with my kid. Yeah, because they got a mind of their own. They are individuals. And sometimes we have to put our foot down and say, no, this is absolutely, you know, out of the realm of acceptability. And if you could blame the school, it's much better for the, at least for the family relationships, you know what I mean? Because the school, it's a rule for the school. They won't like it. They'll throw you out. They'll say, you know, that's much easier than making it a personal issue. But we have to be aware that we have to deal with these issues. I don't believe, and again, you know, if I'm really off base in this wonderful community that's so insular and so perfect, then I apologize. And I mean that sincerely. But my general experience is that if we think we're controlling our kids, we're lulling ourselves into a false state of complacency and security. Because even if I can control them today, the day is not far from here when we won't be able to. So we have to set up the mechanism. And the mechanism is talk. The mechanism is explanation. The mechanism is inspiration, passion. Why this is important. Not forcing, not screaming, not yelling, not demanding, not commanding. And certainly not explaining why it's bad for the shidduchim for their older siblings. Because that one kills them. That means you don't care about me at all. All you care about is my sister. But this is part of the process. The family can remain together as a unit if we can communicate, if the parents are yad achas, and if we're willing to deal with the issues. We must deal with the issues. Now, you know, I'm standing here and I'm trying to gauge the response of the audience, because you know, you really have to know who you're dealing with and what you're dealing with. And I'm not sure that I'm getting a clear reading. But I have to tell you that the problems are increasing. As someone put it to me in this community, you know, like, Baruch Hashem, we're a little bit backward when it comes to these terrible things. And maybe we should figure out how to prevent them so that they shouldn't happen. This general concept of talking, of explaining, of inspiring, of negotiating is part of a system that when there's such an atmosphere in a home, it doesn't have to undermine parental authority. And don't worry so much about parental authority, because parental authority, when the time comes to be undermined, they'll undermine it anyway, no matter what you do. So if we can, we talk, we communicate, we discuss, we exchange ideas, we explain things. And sometimes we even have to call in someone from the outside who's going to give us a little bit of unbiased opinion or unbinding or binding arbitration. I don't know, something. But there's an atmosphere of we can talk. We can talk, we can negotiate, we can talk, we can communicate. It makes a major difference. It could save all kinds of trouble later. What about siblings who are faced with the phenomenon of older, or sometimes even younger, mostly older, siblings who are not behaving properly, and it's very clear that they're not behaving properly? And if we try to keep them at home, as we say, and if we try only to make certain minimal demands, because otherwise it's not going to work anyway, and if these younger siblings know that the older siblings are doing things they shouldn't be doing, and younger siblings tend, certainly girls to girls and boys to boys, and sometimes even, you know, crossing the lines, they tend to look up to their older brother or sister and follow their direction. So what do we do? How do we get around that? So I think that, again, there's no simple answers. But I think there are a few points which might be very helpful and I think very critical to dealing with this problem, because this problem does happen in good places. I don't mean good places, because we're all good people in good places. But in places where the problems aren't so acute, it happens in subtle ways, in subtleties, in inches, maybe in the tznius, in slight differences, maybe in terms of the commitment to learning or the coming to davening on time or whatever else it is. But it's there. It's out there. It's a real problem. And just a few a few things. Number one, let's go back to pressure. For some reason, our children have internalized, if you were to ask our children what they look at a life of Torah and mitzvahs, is it more burden or is it more privilege? How do you think they would answer that question? What?
Burden.
Burden. And how many people have children who answer privilege? You got one with a shaking hand, maybe. Okay, then we got a problem. It's a burden? Wow. Now I understand why it's so critical to make sure that we don't allow our child to deviate in the slightest. Because since it's a terrible burden, the one behind him or her is going to want to follow that deviation or we're in trouble. But maybe, the answer is that it shouldn't be a burden. Maybe the answer is that it's a privilege. Maybe the answer is that we have to show and share and inspire and educate our children that this is, in fact, a privilege. It's the greatest of all privileges. If it's a privilege, how many children do you know that when their elder siblings are deprived of a privilege, for whatever reason it may be, that they now are pushing and fighting and demanding and negotiating also to be deprived of the privileges? Because my brother lost his privileges, I want to lose him too. I never met one. Maybe someone a little bit, not all there. So, but if it's not a privilege, it's going to be a serious problem. It has to be a privilege. Why do our kids not feel such privilege. I don't know if it's pertinent, I don't know if it's necessary, but maybe it's always helpful to get a little bit of a sense of background. I think it's our success as an observant community, as a Haredi community, as a Torah community, is part of the reason that our children don't feel the privilege. They take it for granted. It's not a privilege. What a privilege. What a privilege. Everybody has this. This is it. You know. We were born this way. This is everyone is privileged to a yeshiva education. That's not a privilege. That's certainly a burden. Everyone's privileged to a Shabbos at home, to a chont. That's not a privilege. You know, it's not a burden. You know, sometimes it's a burden, but it's a different kind of burden. But anyway, it's like we don't feel, our children don't necessarily feel, they didn't fight for it like some of us or our parents did. They didn't grow up in communities where they had to be, you know, my kids grew up in North Hollywood, California in the old days before it was a ear of aim to Yisrael like it is today. And, you know, they couldn't eat by any. They couldn't eat by any friend. You know, couldn't eat in the house. Never forget. I hope I didn't tell this joke over here last time. For some reason I had an eerie feeling I did. So I'll never forget my kids knew they couldn't eat in anybody's house. And then my two-year-old girl, daughter, comes home. She says she ate supper already. So I says, well, you're not supposed to eat. She says, no, it was schnitzel just like you make. Anyway, so but they knew. I think it was a kosher house. It just wasn't anyway. But they knew that it was a privilege. We are privileged, and we taught them that they were privileged, and we made them feel that they were privileged. They let them know what it means. You know what it means to keep kosher. You know what it means to have a Shabbos? You know what a Rachmonis it is on the people who don't have a Shabbos? You know what a Rachmonis it is on people who don't even know the phone number of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? How to connect with him? How to talk to him? They never heard about Ashgocha Protis? They never heard about Bitochen? They have no idea what a Yontif is? They have no idea how we have a system of Torah that's Loinitno Torah Mitzvahs and Letzaret Benes Habriyos? That we refine and purify our character, that we become holy people, that we are commanded to emulate HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our midas. We have a system that allows us to develop the highest levels of human perfection. Now, don't talk to your two-year-old that way, please. But you get the idea. You know, it's a privilege. Our kids, when they grow up in community, it's all taken for granted. I guess the word is complacency. We're complacent, our kids are complacent. It's not a privilege, it is a burden no matter which way you slice it. And therefore, if one kid gets away with one burden, the others are going to want to get away with that burden too. But if one kid, we can educate and we can explain, this is really a privilege. Unfortunately, this particular brother or sister doesn't appreciate it. And you can say, and you have to say, they have certain issues, they have certain problems. They have certain experiences in life, and by the way, we're discovering more and more, and I don't want to say more about this topic, that there are negative experiences that children have had which have positioned them for pain and misery and suffering and rebellion in their lives. And you know, you don't have to go into detail, you probably don't even know the details, but just like, you know, they have, and we're working with them. And you know something else? You have to set an exemplary behavior for your older sibling. I mean, you can't do it again to a three-year-old for a 20-year-old, but, and you, or maybe you could. Sometimes a three-year-old could tell you, how do you do that? It's Shabbos, you know, and she starts to cry, and all of a sudden, the guy says, what am I, crazy? I can't do this. But, the kid becomes part of the team that's trying to have the positive hashpoah in this family. But it's extremely important that every one of our children feel accepted in the family. They're part of the team. They're part of this. I like the words now more than I did when I read it at the beginning. They're part of this cohesive unit of diverse individuals. And that gives them strength. You know, according to the theory, and I think I alluded to it before, that our children are testing our love. And they really misbehave oftentimes just to see whether our love for them, and by the way, you know, I should elaborate a little bit more. Our children got the message, certainly in communities like this, that Yiddishkeit is the most important thing in the world. They may not see the passion, they may not see the excitement, they may see it as a fear. Some internalize the fear, I'm afraid to do what I've done, I don't want to get punished. They may see it as a social pressure, but the greatest of all social pressures, speaking French is not the same, I can't get arrested for that, it's not the same social pressure as it is to keep the mitzvahs, but they sense that this is the most important thing in the world. So they know it. And therefore, they come to us and they say like this, they say, you know, I'm not going to do these things. Let's see if you still love me. Let's see if you still accept. I'm dealing now with a young man, very painful situation, but a young man that the greatest word, the one word that's most oft repeated in his language, in his discussions of why he's off the derech, is the judgmental, non-accepting attitude that from people, parents, families, schools, communities have. This just devastates him. Devastates him beyond belief, beyond what he can cope with. And when our kids sense that, so it's like they're going to test us. Are you going to, do you love me because you love me? Or do you love me because I do the things you want me to do? And how do I test that? I test that by doing the things that you don't want me to do and see if you still love me. And how do we fail that test? Because we let them know that we're not happy with them and we withhold some of that love because they're not doing the things that we want them to do. When they see the first sibling, now, by the way, I am not suggesting send your first sibling off the derech so you should be able to strengthen the second one. By no means, please, I don't think anyone's going to make that mistake. But when, Rachmona Litzlan, when we're dealing, and we're dealing even with dakis, you know, ever so slightly, a little bit off, when the second one sees that the first one is accepted, it can preempt this inappropriate behavior, because what it says to them is, you know something, you don't got to go off the derech to be loved in this house, because even if you, you know, either way, even if you're off the derech, you're loved, you're loved for who you are, and has nothing to do with what you do. Your love for me, a child, a person, everyone wants to be loved because I am good. Not because of what I do, but because of who I am. And when our kids get that sense that everybody in this family is accepted, everybody is loved, it's a tremendous, it's like, it almost obviates the need to keep testing. And if you wonder about the power of love, then I would share with you something which I just read at this Shabbos, although I may have mentioned it in my previous talk here, but Yaakov Avinu is concerned that Esau is coming to attack him. He has these 400 soldiers, and he's powerful, he's dangerous, and he's preparing for this onslaught. And he sends him some presents, and he says him, Lovon Garati, Voheli Tsoinu Bokor, catching him up on his life, nothing really deep or personal, but just, you know, what happened to me the last two decades. And the Ralbach says, you see from here how to melt the heart of an enemy. Show him friendship. Yaakov showed Esau friendship. Friendship melts the heart even of a mortal enemy as Esau. I don't get it. First of all, Esau's enmity was eternal. Halochohi, Chazal say, Esau seinei le'Yaakov. It's mamish, like it created, I guess his sin created a chuk hateva that Esau, Adayim Azeh, Esau saying to Yaakov. Such a hatred. And Yaakov? Esau, you know what Esau thought about Yaakov? By Yaakveni Zeh Pamayim. Yeah, you fooled me already. You fooled me with the Bchayra, you fooled me with the Brochas. Now you're fooling me with this false show of love. This is going to melt the heart of a mortal enemy? Weistois, that love, I guess when it's real, I guess there was something real there, but is so powerful an emotion that even if the recipient has the ultimate hatred and has a very big suffix as to whether you really believe it or mean it or not, it could still melt the heart of an enemy. That's the power of love. We must show our love for our children, not for the nachas they bring us, not for the grades they bring home, not for the praises that they get from the neighbors, not for how they serve our purposes, or because they are my, like we used to say, my kaddishol, but because of who they are. You are a wonderful person. You are a quality person. The Gemara says that the Tanoim were walking along and they saw this ugly, dismembered carcass. And everyone commented about it smelled and this. So I think, I'm not sure if it was Rabbi Akiva or someone said, Manoe Shinov. He saw the beautiful teeth. We have to learn to find the beauty in these kids. We have to learn to find the good and to love it to death. To love it. Not because of what you do, just because of who you are. And we have to communicate that. And it's not enough to say, love you, goodbye. And it's not enough to be talking on the cell phone or email or something else. It's not enough to give them 3 minutes every 30 days. It's not even enough to have other people at the Shabbos table all the time and we talk to the guests and not to our children. But to show that I enjoy talking to you. I feel it's a precious opportunity to have a few moments to talk to you. I'm genuinely interested in what happened. How was your day? We don't even listen. Hi, how's your day? Love you. Bye. When that love is there, whatever, I dare say more than that. I tell you from years of experience that I would guess, it's not a very scientific analysis, anecdotal at best, but I would guess that more than anything else, when children act out, they are testing our love that they have not been convinced exists, and the convincing them that it's real will resolve so many of those problems. It's so, so powerful. And it's like, it's as if that's all they really want. That's all they really want. Because, you know, it feels good to be loved. It's validating. Makes you happy. And that's really what life is all about. Cohesiveness of a family. Cohesiveness of a family. Very, very important. If a family is at battle, whether it be, as we mentioned, the husband and wife, or whether it be children and parents, or whether it be siblings amongst themselves, it's not a very pleasant place to be. Yeah. And people don't want to be part of unpleasant communities. It's a community of misery, and I want Chazal says, the last Mishnah in Shas, Lo imotza HaKodesh Baruch Hu kli machzik brocho ela hasholem. HaKodesh Baruch Hu in his entire universe, Boilomoy couldn't find a keli, a vessel that could hold in brocho except for sholem. Shenemar Hashem uiz la'amu yitein Hashem mivorech zamo v'asholem, uiz is a brocho, sholem v'aistus you need sholem to hold brocho. What's the pshat? You know, if you have 1,000 quarters, 5,000 quarters, 100 quarters, and you don't have a kli to hold them in, it's all gone. Falls asunder. If you have all the brochas in the world, I have so much. Oy, look what I have in my family. I have wonderful children, a wonderful spouse, a wonderful husband, a wonderful wife, a beautiful house, a beautiful new car, and we got wonderful, beautiful clothing. The mother is a tremendous cook, and we have money. We got everything in the world to ask for. The only thing is, everybody's always fighting with everybody else. And so not even parental discord, just familial discord. This one doesn't like this, this one did, this one's critical of this, this one's not sensitive to this one. I'll never forget, I was a little kid. My grandmother, Aleh HaShalom, on her deathbed, she was elderly and she was passing, it was close to her passing, and she used to repeat all day long, Der Iker is the Kinder Zolzach nicht schlagen. Her children shouldn't fight with each other. That's all she was concerned about. That's all, just the children shouldn't fight. It's the worst thing in the world. And that wasn't, they were already married and older. That wasn't for a family living under one roof. That was for an extended family. But the Iker is, it should be Shalom Bayis. There should be, if there's Shalom, there's Brocha. If not, all the Brochas fall asunder. All the Brochas fall apart. I got everything going for me and I have nothing because there's no Shalom. And the kid wants to run away. Statistically, we know that to the degree that a house is wholesome and peaceful and welcoming and accepting and inclusive and warm and loving, it's to that degree that people just want to be there. They just want to be there. They want to hang around. They don't want to go anyplace. They don't even want to go to their friends because they're just so comfortable at home. And it isn't the luxurious physical comforts that do it for our kids. Most of our kids will tell you they'll throw away the luxury like nothing. How many kids have gone off the derech and given away fortunes that they were written out of the will and couldn't care less? Because that's not what life is about. They want this peace. They want this love. They want this acceptance. They want this feeling. And it's very, very critical. And it requires working together as a family. You know, the Welt tries to say, oh, you should have a meal, one meal a day with your children. By the way, they have statistics that if a family eats one meal together, then they have so much a diminution of alcohol and substance abuse. And if it's two meals, they have a whole thing. They did a whole study. It's mamish, it's all related. But Shabbos, the family together, talk to each other. Make sure if there's two kids that have friction, work out the problem. Work it out. See, explain, talk to them. Never forget, my twins, they were young. There was once a bitter fight going on. And I walked into the house and I was going to really resolve this fight. The minute I got involved, they both ganged up on me. You know, they united. And so you got to be careful how you do it. It's not very simple. But work with them. Everybody should live. It should be cohesive. A cohesive unit of diverse individuals. Everybody is different, but yet we can all live together. Because we are tolerant. Because we do love each other. Because we love people for who they are. See the good in people. I'll tell you another secret that I've learned over the years. See the good in your children. Believe the good in your children. Even if they're not what you think they are, they'll rise to the occasion. Because children rise to the expectations of the important individuals in their lives. And when we hold from them, oh, you're so good, you're so kind. I'm so kind. Yeah, I better start. And we start, and we become. So it's and if there's fighting, if there's arguing, work it out, talk to them, explain to them what it means. This one's because of this, they had a hard this, they have a problem here, this one has a problem here. Get them involved, talk to them. Not everything has to be a secret, not everything has to be cold, not everything has to be businesslike. Create within the expectations and the framework and the structure of a family, but create a unit of people that get along with each other, that are accepting, that are loving, that are caring. That doesn't mean forcing your older kid to take along the younger kid when they go to their friends, because they're not going to want to do that. But it does mean doing something else for that poor crying kid who's left behind crying because she can't go along with her sister who's 5 years older, you know, and make it up to them, Motzoi Shabbos, make it up to them another time. Teach your kids to give gifts to their siblings, pay for them, give it to them, buy it for them, but show that they care. Everybody shows that they care. Not love you goodbye, but really feel it. That feeling, that love, that shalom creates the base kibul for all the brochas, and that love creates a receptiveness to be able to go beyond any type of obstacles that we may have. Inspiring our children to succeed. I think that's the last piece to this formula, this family team that's working together as a cohesive unit of diverse individuals, how it can inspire your children to succeed. How do we inspire our children to succeed? What can we do? Well, one thing, as we mentioned, is believing in them. Believing in our children is probably the most powerful tool that we have to inspire them with their own worth and value, and give them the tools and the kuyfis with which to succeed. I'll never forget the early days when we started our high school for kids that are in trouble. A young man who was tremendous yichus mamish. I want to mention who his ancestors were. Problems. His difficulty was as great, if not greater, than his yichus. And in about 6 months, he started slowly to shape up. Started to turn around a little bit. And I turned to him one day and I said to him, "What happened? What changed? What did it?" So he looked at me and he says, "You did it." I says, "I did it." I says, "I barely talked to you. I have no time. I feel bad." He says, "No, you believed in me." That's all. Very bright boy. "You believed in me." That's all I did for him. I really did nothing else. But I believed in him. And believing in him gave him the power to become great. To change his whole life. You know, there's a famous story that's going around about... it's very well known. I'm sure you've heard it or read it or something. About a young boy in a yeshiva who was thrown out of class every single day. Every day, the same story. Go to the principal. The principal makes the same speech to him, and same thing happens again. One day, he goes to the principal's office, comes out, different human being, perfect from now to the rest of the year. Nobody understood what happened. Nobody even dared to think or to ask what happened. Everybody was amazed. At the end of the year, one teacher finally asked the principal, "What'd you do? What's different? What happened?" He says, "I have no idea. I have the same question." So he calls the kid in and he asks him, he says, "What happened?" So he says, "When you were talking to me this last time before I changed, the secretary came in and said you have an important phone call. And you said, I can't take the phone call because I'm talking to one of the most important people in the world." That's it. I'm important? All of a sudden, the power. This kid didn't have the koyach to behave. He couldn't behave. You think he wanted to get thrown out every single day? He couldn't control himself. All of a sudden, I'm the most important person, one of the most important. Now all of a sudden, I'm a different human being. This is how we can inspire our children to succeed, by believing in them. We also have to, as a family, especially of diverse individuals, we also have to help our children find ways of succeeding that may not be mainstream. Now, I'm sure that I've touched on this before here, I believe, but I think it's imperative to repeat it again. You know, everybody has to find ways to feel good about themselves. Success, really, if I succeed, I feel validated, I feel good about myself, I feel happy, and the rest is history. Now, if I'm not succeeding in my yeshiva studies, right, that's a problem, I'm not succeeding. So you say, well, I don't succeed in learning, but I succeed in the secular subjects. I don't succeed in academics. I succeed in sports and music and art and something else. Well, I have to tell you that it seems to me from experience and what I know from out there is that it's not the same thing. Our kids know that they need success in Yiddishkeit. They need success in Torah. Because that's the most important thing. They've gotten that message from us. And therefore, just to be good at basketball and not to be good at learning, it's something. It makes me feel a little better than nothing. I have such a young man now. He came to us in the yeshiva. He's top of the line. In sports, there's nobody like him. But he has never learned. And he's a tzibruchen keili through and through. He doesn't feel he even has a purpose in this world. Even though he's a star at any sport. Because he got the message from his family and from his upbringing and his background and his yeshiva that, hey, what really counts is not basketball. What really counts is not football. What really counts is Yiddishkeit. So we have to find. And one of the things which I mention all the time is that there are many kids, I just had it again yesterday, kim'at every week, at least a few situations, where the father described a kid who is weak. He's a weak student. He's a weak Gemara student. He doesn't do well in Gemara. He can't learn. He can even read, but he just can't understand what's going on. But he does have, he's good in Chumash, he's good. I didn't even meet the kid yet, but I can guarantee you that the kid is a different kind of a learner. He can't get a lot of information all at once. He can't take in all this information without interacting with it. He can't sit and listen. Maybe he doesn't have any great concentration either. You know, sit and listen to so many pieces of information without some interactive involvement, without being able to question, without delving into understanding. And he comes off as stupid because he can't fit the system the way it's being done. But if the system for him would change, and if they can't change the system, or he can't find a school that could help him, then at least a tutor or someone who could rebuild that sense of feeling good about himself, that, hey, I can do it, I can understand it. Just let me ask a question, just give me a chance to internalize it, just to you know, and he could be, who cares, he could be a star. And many of our kids are like this. Because they're not getting good grades, because they're not participating, because everybody seems to say they're stupid, or they don't know what's going on, or they can't concentrate, or they're not academically inclined. Or it doesn't have to be true. And I'll tell you two things. Number one, if we are aware of the fact that oftentimes this is a misdiagnosis, because if someone delves into it a little more, just see they have a little bit of a different learning style. And number two, if they see, once we have that suspicion, that we start believing in them, they soar. They become, they reach a different level of accomplishment. Our belief in them will inspire them to succeed. And I guess that, I guess besides all of this, and this is just to throw it out, not to belabor it. I think the hour is late. If we want our children to succeed, we have to give them a sense not only of self-esteem and feeling good about themselves and believing in them, but also a sense of trusting in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Success, I think we live in times now where everyone is beginning to realize that without bitochon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's impossible to make it. I hope the situation in Canada is not as dismal as it looks in the States, but our children have to know that. We have to learn to trust HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, together, paralleling that sense of believing in them, believing in Him and believing in them, is a winning combination that can uplift our children and give them the tools that they need to succeed in this world. And in closing, I would just like to say one more thing. And this I say to you from a lot of personal experience with people. There are many people out there who are not religious, people who were never religious, people who went off the derech, that through connecting them with bitochon b'Hashem, and that bitochon draws them back. They develop a relationship. You see, the relationship of bitochon doesn't have to be a religious observant. It's a religious, but not an observant experience. Chazal say, Rabbi machoivim l'rosho, v'abeteach b'Hashem chesed yesevevenu. Afilu, Chazal darshan, that's the posuk, Chazal darshan, afilu rosho, v'abeteach b'Hashem chesed yesevevenu. Even if a person's a rosho, if he trusts Hashem, he'll be surrounded with chesed. And people out there, whether it's kids that are drifting or our kids that are shaky or not even shaky yet at all, and we don't know what's going to be, or whether it's people that have no shaychus to Yiddishkeit, they can buy into, they can be inspired by bitochon because that's something that they want. That's something that's self-serving. That's something that they can appreciate. They connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and it starts permeating their whole existence. So it's certainly a worthwhile endeavor to try to strengthen in our homes that sense of bitochon b'Hashem, that complementing the sense of believing in our children, the cohesive environment, and the working together as a team and as a unit, can certainly be Ezras Hashem b'siyata d'shmaya grant us the type of achievements, the type of accomplishments, the type of nachas that we all so desperately crave to have from our children. Rabbeinu Shalom should bench us all to be able to follow some of these guidelines and implement them in our families, and be'emes to see some of the most wonderful and heartwarming results. I know the hour is late. I don't know how late it is locally. I mean, I know the local time, but if there's any time for discussion or... Ah, look at that. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yes? A little louder, please. Sorry. But there is a reality that can be changed, and that's the reality of his capabilities in learning. This boy happens to be, we've discovered over the last, he's just here for a few months, that he's quite bright. He has no idea how bright he is, but he's quite bright. And by gradually getting him into the learning according to his unique style and needs and this, he's beginning to discover that, hey, you know, what have I been thinking all these years? And it can be done. Most of our kids, you know what I love to say, it's my favorite line. They've called us every name in the book. You never heard anyone call a stupid Jew. You know, most of our kids have a lot more capabilities than we realize. And we have to help them to discover it and to actualize them. I think in this particular case that can be done, we're doing it, and it can be done in many cases. Yes?
How old is the child that you're talking about?
This particular one?
Yes.
16? More, 17? Yeah. Yes?
One of the problems, I think, is that we try to cut the child to fit the suit in a lot of these years, and not the suit to fit the child. How do you feel about vocational kids that really, and not, you know, I mean, they probably should learn, but they should also take a vocational stream.
Okay.
That would be selective. In other words, it wouldn't be open to everybody. Yeah.
Okay. I have mixed feelings about it. you know, I'm certainly sympathetic to that need. What I've seen, though, over the years is, and this is the abuse of that system, and that is that far too many who could have made it fully academically in every way. I mean, may not have been the Iluyim from the class, but who could have made it academically are now being shortchanged and not being academic. And that wouldn't be so terrible, except for the fact that later on, when they realize that they could do better, they feel frustrated. So that's I would be very wary of those kinds of problems. The majority of the kids that we would relegate to vocational programs probably could do well and even better in a program that just dealt with their specific needs.
But that would be, you know, when I'm talking about the vocational program, I'm looking at kids that are already off the Derek.
Okay, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I just can't resist. I have a school full of kids. They had made a special high school about 14 years ago of kids who were off the derech already. In fact, it's the only real entrance requirement is to be off the derech. And I have to tell you that some of these kids are Rosh Hashivas today. Some of the finest Yungalite in our kollel are from our high school. I have to tell you that one of the schools in Israel came back to us and called us, said that the Rebbeim, they call us Ponovish Incognito. Because listen to that, that's a line. Because we're sending them these kids who are off the derech, but when they come to the yeshiva there, they become the stars. So I don't think that you may be, you know, making a mistake about that one.
It's not a question of mistake, it's a question that would be highly selective. In In other words, it's not that it's open to
okay, anybody. Okay, all right. But, you know, that's... I would say like this. If before a community undertakes something like that, they should certainly undertake a program of identifying the unique and individual learning styles of students so they don't end up putting people who don't really belong there and will be frustrated later on, something like that. Yes?
How do you believe in a child if the school doesn't believe in themselves?
Ooh. I don't know. I know the answer to that question. I don't know how to answer that question, if you know what I mean. That's really, really very difficult. The question is, how do you believe in a child, how did it go, that the school doesn't believe in? Change schools. You know, I don't know if you have those options. You know, in some communities, you do have those options. I'm not sure that you have that option in every community. I would say to you as follows, that you probably will not find every member of the school team to be an ally if you're suggesting that they don't believe in the child. But you probably could find, in the name of a principal, assistant principal, one teacher, someone there who knows the child, who can get to know the child better, who can become convinced that this child has it, and maybe through that to get at least a couple of other people, and then you know what you're doing. This is really where I hope the educators don't listen to me. You have to start to emphasize in the life of this child that these teachers know him or her better. The other teachers don't really know him truthfully, and therefore this is the information that he should take more seriously and something like that. That's the only eitzah. The other eitzah, though, is that you have to work even harder to validate that child and to make sure that you get mentors, you know, people from the outside who can work with that child. Everybody, all they sing the same song. If everybody's singing the same song, you'll drown out the chorus from the school. I mean, you got a chance. That's the best I could do with that. Okay, yes?
In other words, a child who would be found in a particular situation would need an individual, another individual, to make them grow. In other words, this whole system, the way it is, would be a class of 20 or a class of, would not be good for that kind of child.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, if you can't provide a one-to-one school, if you could, that might be good. Of course, you have to take into consideration the social issues. But if you can't provide a one-to-one school, at least provide a one-to-one tutorial, a mentorship, something where at least part of the day this child is getting that which they need. You know, you'd have to do as best you can on that. You can't.
But I'm thinking in terms of,
okay.
Okay. So isn't it because of the fact that we live in a system where it's always a school?
Yeah, but
where you have to be in a positive.
All right, but that's the system we live in, and that's not going to change. Yeah.
But this particular child, a child who really needs help or needs this kind of attention, he needs a one.
Okay, as much as you can do that, you should, absolutely. Okay, thank you very much. Kol tov, hatzlocha rabba.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org. Where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.